Chapter 5. Aggressive Predisposition of the Killer. Avengers, Conditioning, and the 2% Who Like It. World War II-era training was conducted on a grassy firing range, a known distance range, on which the soldiers shot at a bullseye target. After he fired a series of shots, the target was checked, and he was then given feedback that told him where he hit. Modern training uses what is essentially B.F. Skinner's operant conditioning techniques to develop a firing behavior in the soldier. This training comes as close to simulating actual combat conditions as possible. The soldier stands in a foxhole with full combat equipment, and man-shaped targets pop up briefly in front of him. These are the eliciting stimuli that prompt the target behavior of shooting. If the target is hit, it immediately drops, thus providing immediate feedback. Positive reinforcement is given when these hits are exchanged for marksmanship badges, which usually have some form of privilege or reward associated with them, praise, recognition, or three-day passes. Traditional marksmanship training has been transformed into a combat simulator. Watson states that soldiers who have conducted this kind of simulator training often report, after they have met a real-life emergency, that they just carried out the correct drill and completed it before they realized they were not in a simulator. Vietnam veterans have repeatedly reported similar experiences. Several independent studies indicate that this powerful conditioning process has dramatically increased the firing rate of American soldiers since World War II. Richard Holmes has noted the effectiveness of an army trained in traditional World War II methods as opposed to an army whose soldiers have been conditioned by modern training methods. Holmes interviewed British soldiers returning from the Falklands War and asked them if they had experienced any incidents of non-firing similar to that observed by Marshall in World War II. The British, who had been trained by modern methods, had not seen any such thing in their soldiers, but they had definitely observed it in the Argentinians, who had received World War II-style training and whose only effective fire had come from machine guns and snipers. The value of this modern battle-proofing can also be seen in the war in Rhodesia in the 1970s. The Rhodesian Security Force was a highly trained modern army fighting against an ill-trained band of guerrillas. Through superior tactics and training, the security force maintained an overall kill ratio of about 8-1 throughout the war. Their commando units actually improved their kill ratios from 35-1 to 50-1. The Rhodesians achieved this in an environment in which they did not have air and artillery support, nor did they have a significant advantage in weapons over their Soviet-supported opponents. The only thing they had going for them was superior training, and the advantage this gave them added up to nothing less than total tactical superiority. The effectiveness of modern conditioning techniques that enable killing in combat is irrefutable, and their impact on the modern battlefield is enormous. Recent experiences. That's for my brother. Quote, Bob Fowler, F Company's popular tow-headed commander, had bled to death after being shot in the spleen. His orderly, who adored him, snatched up a submachine gun and unforgivably massacred a line of unarmed Japanese soldiers who had just surrendered. William Manchester, Goodbye Darkness. The recent loss of friends and beloved leaders in combat can also enable violence on the battlefield. The deaths of friends and comrades can stun, paralyze, and emotionally defeat soldiers. But in many circumstances, soldiers react with anger, which is one of the well-known response stages to death and dying. And then the loss of comrades can enable killing. Our literature is full of examples, and even our law includes concepts such as temporary insanity and extenuating and mitigating circumstances. Revenge killing during a burst of rage has been a recurring theme throughout history, and it needs to be considered in the overall equation of factors that enable killing on the battlefield. The soldier in combat is a product of his environment, and violence can beget violence. This is the nurture side of the nature-nurture question. But he is also very much influenced by his temperament, or the nature side of the nature-nurture equation. And that is a subject that we will now address in detail. The temperament of the natural soldier. Quote, there is such a thing as a natural soldier, the kind who derives his greatest satisfaction from male comradeship, from excitement, and from the conquering of physical obstacles. He doesn't want to kill people as such, but he will have no objections if it occurs within a moral framework that gives him justification, like war, and if it is the price of gaining admission to the kind of environment he craves. Whether such men are born or made, I do not know, but most of them end up in armies, and many move on again to become mercenaries because regular army life in peacetime is too routine and boring. But armies are not full of such men. They are so rare that they form only a modest fraction, even of small professional armies, mostly congregating in the commando-type special forces. In large conscript armies, they virtually disappear beneath the weight of numbers of more ordinary men. And it is these ordinary men who do not like combat at all that armies must persuade to kill. Until only a generation ago, they did not even realize how bad a job they were doing. Gwen Dyer, War. Swank and Marchand's World War II study noted the existence of 2% of combat soldiers who are predisposed to be aggressive psychopaths and apparently did not experience the normal resistance to killing and the resultant psychiatric casualties associated with extended periods of combat. But the negative connotations associated with the term psychopath or its modern equivalent sociopath are inappropriate here, since this behavior is a generally desirable one for soldiers in combat. It would be absolutely incorrect to conclude that 2% of all veterans are psychopathic killers. Numerous studies indicate that combat veterans are no more inclined to violence than non-vets. A more accurate conclusion would be that there is 2% of the male population that, if pushed, or if given a legitimate reason, will kill without regret or remorse. What these individuals represent, and this is a terribly important point that I must emphasize, is the capacity for the level-headed participation in combat that we as a society glorify and that Hollywood would have us believe that all soldiers possess. In the course of interviewing veterans as a part of this study, I've met several individuals who may fit within this 2%. And since returning from combat, they have, without fail, proven themselves to be above-average contributors to the prosperity and welfare of our society. Dyer draws from his own personal experience as a soldier to understand. Aggression is certainly part of our genetic makeup, and necessarily so. But the normal human being's quota of aggression will not cause him to kill acquaintances, let alone wage war against strangers from a distant country. We live among millions of people who have killed fellow human beings with pitiless efficiency, machine-gunning them, using flamethrowers on them, dropping explosive bombs on them from 20,000 feet up. Yet we do not fear these people. The overwhelming majority of those who have killed, now or at any time in the past, have done so as soldiers in war, and we recognize that that has practically nothing to do with the kind of personal aggression that would endanger us as their fellow citizens. Marshall's World War II figure of a 15 to 20% firing rate does not necessarily contradict Swank and Marchand's 2% figure, since many of these firers were under extreme empowerment circumstances, and many may have been in a posturing mode and merely firing wildly or above the enemy's heads. And later firing rate figures of 55% in Korea and 90 to 95% in Vietnam represent the actions of men empowered by increasingly more effective conditioning processes. But these figures also do not tell us how many were posturing. Dyer's World War II figure of 1% of U.S. Army Air Corps fighter pilots being responsible for 40% of all kills is also generally in keeping with the Swank and Marchand estimates. Eric Hartmann, the World War II German ace, unquestionably the greatest fighter pilot of all time, with 351 confirmed victories, claimed that 80% of his victims never knew he was in the same sky with them. This claim, if accurate, provides a remarkable insight into the nature of such a killer. Like the kills of most successful snipers and fighter pilots, the vast majority of the killing done by these men were what some would call simple ambushes and back shootings. No provocation, anger, or emotion empowered these killings. Several senior U.S. Air Force officers have told me that when the U.S. Air Force tried to pre-select fighter pilots after World War II, the only common denominator they could find among their World War II aces was that they had been involved in a lot of fights as children. Not bullies, for most true bullies avoid fights with anyone who is reasonably capable of fighting them, but fighters. If you can recapture or imagine the anger and indignity a child feels in a schoolyard fight, and magnify that into a way of life, Then you can begin to understand these individuals and their capacity for violence. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association, indicates that the incidence of antisocial personality disorder, that is, sociopaths, among the general population of American males is approximately 3%. These sociopaths are not easily used in armies, since by their very nature they rebel against authority. But over the centuries, armies have had considerable success at bending such highly aggressive individuals to their will during wartime. So if 2 out of 3 of this 3% were able to accept military discipline, a hypothetical 2% of soldiers would, by the APA's definition, have no remorse about the effects of their behavior on others. There is strong evidence that there exists a genetic predisposition for aggression. In all species, the best hunter, the best fighter, the most aggressive male, survives to pass his biological predispositions on to his descendants. There are also environmental processes that can fully develop this predisposition towards aggression. When we combine this genetic predisposition with environmental development, we get a killer. But there is another factor, the presence or absence of empathy for others. Again, there may be biological and environmental causes for this empathic process. But whatever its origin, there is undoubtedly a division in humanity between those who can feel and understand the pain and suffering of others and those who cannot. The presence of aggression, combined with the absence of empathy, results in sociopathy. The presence of aggression, combined with the presence of empathy, results in a completely different kind of individual from the sociopath. One veteran I interviewed told me that he thought of most of the world as sheep, gentle, decent, kindly creatures, who are essentially incapable of true aggression. In this veteran's mind, there is another human subspecies, of which he is a member, and that is a kind of dog. Faithful, vigilant creatures, who are very much capable of aggression when circumstances require. But, according to his model, there are wolves, sociopaths, and packs of wild dogs, gangs, and aggressive armies abroad in the land. And the sheepdogs, the soldiers and policemen of the world, are environmentally and biologically predisposed to be the ones who confront these predators. Some experts in the psychological and psychiatric community think that these men are simply sociopaths, and that the above view of killers is romanticizing. But I believe that there is another category of human beings out there. We know about sociopaths because their condition is, by definition, a pathology or a psychological disorder. But the psychological community does not recognize this other category of human beings, these metaphoric sheepdogs, because their personality type does not represent pathology or disorder. Indeed, they are valuable and contributing members of our society. And it is only in time of war or on police forces that these characteristics can be observed. I've met these men, these sheepdogs, over and over again as I interviewed veterans. There are men like one U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, a Vietnam veteran, who told me, "I learned early on in life that there are people out there who will hurt you if given a chance, and I have devoted my life to being prepared to face them." These men are quite often armed and always vigilant. They would not misuse or misdirect their aggression any more than a sheepdog would turn on his flock. But in their hearts, many of them yearn for a righteous battle, a wolf upon whom to legitimately and lawfully turn their skills. Richard Heckler speaks of this yearning in his book, In Search of the Warrior Spirit. "This urgent calling of nature longs to be tested, seeks to be challenged beyond itself. The warrior within us beseeches Mars, the god of war, to deliver us to that crucial battlefield that will redeem us into the terrifying immediacy of the moment. We want to face our Goliath so that we may be reminded that the warrior David is alive in us. We pray to the war gods to guide us to the walls of Jericho so that we may dare the steadfastness and strength of our trumpet call. We aspire to be defeated in battles by powers so much greater than ourselves that the defeat itself will have made us larger than when we arrived. We long for the encounter that will ultimately empower us with dignity and honor. Be not mistaken. The longing is there, and it's loving and terrible and beautiful and tragic." Perhaps there's another analogy. According to Carl Jung, there are deeply ingrained models for behavior called archetypes that exist deep in every human's collective unconscious, an inherited, unconscious reservoir of images derived from our ancestors' universal experiences and shared by the whole human race. These powerful archetypes can drive us by channeling our libidinal energy. They include such Jungian concepts as the mother, the wise old man, the hero, and the warrior. I think that Jung might refer to these individuals not as sheepdogs, but as warriors and heroes. As stated, this 1% of World War II fighter pilots, Swank and Marchand's 2%, Griffith's low Napoleonic and Civil War killing rates, and Marshall's low World War II firing rates can all be at least partially explained if only a small percentage of these combatants were actually willing to actively kill the enemy in these combat situations, whether called sociopaths, sheepdogs, warriors, or heroes. They are there. They are a distinct minority, and in times of danger, a nation needs them desperately.